When it comes to the Crusades, has quote-unquote propaganda trumped truth? The basic answer to that question would be yes, according to an author of a new book. Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is Professor Steve Weidenkopf, professor at a Catholic university and the author of The Glory of the Crusades, crusadesbook.com. This book is so politically incorrect, it's amazing. Now, just a few weeks ago, President Obama said at the National Prayer Breakfast, he essentially blamed the modern Islamic jihad on the Crusades, or at least you could say he committed moral equivalence. And in the modern talking points, there's probably no human being worse than a crusader. But to separate fact from fiction, Steve Weidenkopf joins us. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jerry. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, the Crusades, what prompted you to write a book about that and to actually defend them?
Sure. Well, you know, there's a lot of misinformation, as you've mentioned there, about the Crusades in the modern world. And so I wanted to write a book that brings to light a lot of authentic scholarship that has occurred in the academy over the last 40 years or so, specifically on the Crusades, which has really overturned all of this kind of modern myths that are believed about these events. And so I wanted to take that scholarship and then bring it to a much wider audience so that people can know what actually happened on these Crusades, know why people actually participated in them, and then be able to defend the Church, because she is usually, the Crusades are one of those events that people use in the modern world to attack the Church and try to discredit the Church and the spread of the gospel.
Hmm. All right. Well, first of all, let me ask you this. How many people total were killed from the Crusades?
Well, there's no real good estimate in terms of how many people were killed. I mean, we do have estimates in terms of how many crusaders who, like the percentage of crusaders, how many actually participated in a particular crusade, and then how many actually came home from that crusade. As an example, on the first crusade, it's estimated that about 80% of those who participated never came home. So that was death either from battle or more often than not actually from famine and starvation and disease and whatnot during the course of the journey. So, I mean, we have those kinds of reliable estimates, but in terms of, you know, how many numbers were killed in this battle or this siege or that siege, it's really, they're at most guesstimates, frankly.
Hmm. All right, now, wouldn't it be safe to say that the Crusades definitely came in response to what Islam had been doing for about 450 years prior to the First Crusade, correct?
Exactly, yeah. The Crusades were seen by medieval people who participated in them as, you know, just wars. So they were armed pilgrimages that were designed to return to Christ and the Church the land that had been Christian for centuries, that had been taken over by Islam, as you mentioned, very soon after Islam was founded in the 7th century, and thereafter you had a very violent conquest by Islamic forces over those ancient Christian territories in the Holy Land, and in North Africa, and even into some Spain and Portugal.
Hmm. Now, your book, which is called The Glory of the Crusades, and again, for more information on it, you can go to crusadesbook.com. You said you set out to disprove these points. One, and these are common myths held about the Crusades. One, the Crusades were wars of unprovoked aggression. Two, the Crusaders were motivated primarily by greed and the prospect for plunder and riches. Three, when Jerusalem was liberated in 1099, the Crusaders killed all the inhabitants of the city. So much blood was spilled that it ran ankle deep. Four, the Crusades were colonial enterprises. Five, the Crusades were also wars against the Jews and should be seen as the first Holocaust. Six, the Crusades were wars of conversion. In other words, convert or die. I've heard that somewhere before. And seventh, the Crusades are the source of the modern tension between Islam and the West. We could spend the whole program just dealing with each of those seven myths. In fact, why don't we? I think that's a great... we've already kind of touched on the fact that these were not wars of unprovoked aggression. In other words, they came after all these years of Islamic invasion. Anything you want to add to that point, point number one?
Sure, yeah. The only thing I would add is this specifically kind of what prompted the Crusade. I mean, I get this question a lot in terms of, well, you know, you have Islam, it arises in the 7th century, they go on this conquest from the 7th through the 8th century, and then all of a sudden the Crusades happen in 1095. Well, you know, so there's several centuries there, so why did it take Christendom so long to respond? is one of the frequent questions I get in terms of that particular myth. And the answer to that is multifaceted. A lot of things going on geopolitically in Christendom during those intervening centuries that didn't allow Christendom to marshal such a force to be able to try to take back this territory. So that's one reason. But really what kind of throws this into Christendom's, on their horizon or really motivates them to react in the 11th century was you have a group of people called the Seljuk Turks who were from the Asian steppe. These are, they've been converted to Islam, so they're Muslims, but they're not Arabs. They come down off the Asian steppe and they begin to invade and encroach upon the Eastern Roman Empire, what we call the Byzantine Empire, into those Christian lands. And in particular, they come down and they attack the Byzantines in the Byzantine province of Anatolia, which is modern-day Turkey, Asia Minor. And they win a huge battle, the Battle of Manzikert in 1071, on the Anatolia plain, and they actually capture the Byzantine emperor. They haul him off into chains. It was a huge loss, this loss of this province to the Byzantines. It was the source of most of their food, actually, also a source of great recruitment for their army. So the loss of it was economically and militarily devastating for the Byzantines. So a later emperor who kind of after that battle over the next decade or so actually tries to strengthen the Byzantine Empire again and try to recover from this devastating loss. He is still dealing with the Seljuk Turks and their encroachment on his territory, this Christian territory, so he decides he needs help. And he writes a letter to the one Western ruler that he believed could marshal enough forces and had enough gravitas, so to speak, to get enough knights warriors to come to his aid. And so he writes a letter to the Pope and asks the Pope to come and to help him defend this territory against the Seljuk Turks.
So and this is Urban II?
Correct, yeah. Okay. So the one who responds, initially he sends a letter to Pope St. Gregory VII, but Gregory VII is dealing with his own internal political issues in Christendom at the time, doesn't have the ability to respond. So a later successor, Blessed Pope Urban II, is the one who responds and calls the First Crusade at a local meeting of French bishops at the city of Clermont in 1095. And then Western knights respond en masse and then meet up in Constantinople to then pursue the objective of the First Crusade, which was to liberate the Holy City of Jerusalem specifically.
You know, it's interesting. When you think about world history and you think about the power of a speech, okay, you can probably identify maybe a dozen speeches in world history that just made a huge difference for the hearers and so forth. And honestly, that speech, whether you agree or disagree, that speech had to have been something. In 1095, for here this man coming from Italy and speaking to these French knights and so forth, to manage to get them to galvanize and uproot and go away to this venture where only, as you say, only 20% returned alive years later. I mean, it was just quite something, agree or disagree, at least it was an incredible speech for him to be able to do that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that speech that Urban gave there in 1095, in November in 1095.
Do we have the record of it, by the way? The actual speech?
Yeah, well, there's not, I mean, there's not like a transcript like we would have today, the president gives a speech and we have a transcript of those things. So there was no one there who was actually transcribing it, but there are many manuscripts of what he said that were recorded and written down later. So, there are people who remembered the speech, remember the high points of the speech, who wrote it down. Crusaders, people who actually went on crusade, who more than likely, one individual, Fulcher of Chartres, was a crusade chronicler. He went on the First Crusade. He records what Urban says and others. So there's, he obviously had heard the speech, and so he writes down later how, what he remembers about the speech. So there's not a word for word kind of transcription of it, but it's people who heard it or who talked to people who heard it, who then wrote down the main themes of what it was that Urban said. So, and the fact that, as you mentioned, it was a very, very, important speech, and it ushered in this 600-year movement, to reclaim and to liberate this Christian territory from the hands of Islam.
Well, you say 600 years, and yet officially I understand the Crusades is lasting only about 200 years.
Well, when you talk about the Crusades, you have to kind of expand the definition. The Crusades really were a movement. There are many historians, myself included in my book at least, I use the 8 traditionally numbered Crusades, which lasted from 1095 to 1270, so about 200 years. But when you look at the movement as a whole, as most crusade historians do now, it's beyond just the eight traditional crusades. So, you know, we recognize that those were eight very specific campaigns that were crusades, but the movement continued on even after that. You had, during the 15th and the 16th century and even into the 17th century, you have the rise of the Ottoman Turks. And the Ottoman Turks invade Europe they go through Central Europe, actually make their way into Vienna twice, once in the 16th century, once in the 17th century. And those events, that defense of Europe, of Central Europe, that defense of Vienna, the Battle of Lepanto, for example, in the Mediterranean in the 16th century, and other campaigns, are all considered also part of the crusading movement.
Well, and then the Valley, the Battle of Vienna. I mean, if Vienna had been lost, and I understand, by the way, that the victory for the West came on September 11th, 1683, was it, in Vienna. And without that victory, I mean, you know, Christendom could easily have been extinguished, easily.
People
forget this. Mm-hmm. In some ways, there's almost a debt that we as modern people have toward the Crusaders, agree with them or disagree with them. There's a debt. I mean, Robert Spencer, who writes a lot about Islam, and he wrote the book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. He said, you know, in some ways, the Crusaders set back by 1,000 years the jihad movement that we're dealing with now.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean,
you would agree with that?
Wow. I've heard Spencer, I've read many of his works, but I haven't necessarily heard him say that specific piece of it. But, to me, you know, on the surface, that makes sense, most definitely. I mean, Islam was definitively defeated, we could say, you know, outside the gates of Vienna in the 17th century. And after that, you know, the Ottoman Turks were the largest Islamic empire at the time. Were kind of a shell of themselves after that, never able to launch any kind of significant offensive campaign against Europe after that point. And then, you know, when you get to the 20th century, they actually side on the wrong side of the First World War with the Germans and lose. And so after that, you know, their empire is demolished and dismantled. And then you have kind of, you know, Islam being latent until really our day and age now, late 20th century, early 21st century.
Hmm. Okay, the Crusades were motivated primarily by greed and the prospect for plunder and riches. What was the motive of the Crusaders for the most part?
Sure. So for the most part, the vast majority of those who went on crusade went for one specific reason that I like to say. And the one reason they went was for love. Which kind of shocks people, and they think, well, why would they go, you know, what is it that motivated them out of love? And it was really love in three different ways, I mean, 3 degrees. They had love and concern for those Christians, indigenous Christians, who were living in the Holy Land and in North Africa at the time, who were being persecuted by the Seljuks, along with the Byzantines. So they had love of their and concern for their fellow Christians. They had also concern and love for Western Christians, who were leaving from Christendom and going to Jerusalem on pilgrimage and who also were being harassed and killed and persecuted. And then they had concern and love for themselves. They were concerned for their own salvation. And one of the main reasons that people went on the crusade was Pope Urban II granted a spiritual benefit, the indulgence, for those who participated in the crusade. And for most people, that was this opportunity to gather and gain the spiritual benefit was what motivated most of them who went. You know, this whole notion that they went for money, for greed, or even to, establish territory or conquer land and create these colonies, that was not the prime motivator for most people. The vast majority of those who went on crusade came back far impoverished for the adventure than than if they had stayed home.
Okay, so now we, as this is an evangelical radio station, so we would have, you know, theological and spiritual difference with the whole idea of indulgences. But your point is that for the most part, these people were motivated by a spiritual quest and not gain, monetary gain. Correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, that's the main point, is that they were motivated for that spiritual benefit, that they saw themselves as I mentioned earlier, they saw themselves participating in an armed pilgrimage. So the first crusaders referred to themselves as God's army. They believed that, you know, God was watching over them, that was caring for them. There were many times on the crusade, the first crusade in particular, where it looked like they were going to be destroyed, and, you know, miraculous events happened to allow them to continue and even to succeed when they shouldn't have, you know, temporally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this real overarching sense of piety and holiness among those who actually went. They frequently fasted before battles. They participated in penitential exercises along the campaigns. Even from a medieval perspective, a crusade army was significantly different than your average ordinary army who was out trying to do something else in Western Europe, you know, conquer somebody else's land or what have you. And the contemporaries saw that and noted that about the Crusades.
Okay. Now, when they got to Jerusalem in 1099, there was a slaughter of a lot of innocent people. And I think that is one of the key things that has brought dishonor to the name of Christ related to the Crusades. But
sure,
has it been overtold?
Yeah, I think that it's been a bit exaggerated in terms of the numbers who were killed and the focusing on it. What just as a side note, I mean, one of the things that bothers me most about the kind of modern telling of the Crusades is this notion that many people kind of focus on the exceptions. I mean, no one is, and I myself, not in my book, I don't whitewash the history. I don't say, well, nothing bad happened. You know, I call those events out and say, here are times when, you know, the Crusaders did not do things that were appropriate or not in keeping with their pious and holy venture. And so, you know, we have to acknowledge those and see those. But what I have issue with is that most people in the modern world take those exceptions and they say, see, that's the norm. That's what the Crusades were all about. Instead of actually looking at the historical context and seeing that those events were they were the exception to the rule. They weren't the normal part of how people behaved on these adventures. So when you get to Jerusalem, you know, even, former President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I've got that right in front of me. November 7, 2001, he's speaking to Georgetown University. So this is just 2 months after 9/11. Those of us who come from various European lineages are not blameless. Indeed, in the First Crusade, when the Christian soldiers took Jerusalem, they first burned a synagogue with 300 Jews in it and proceeded to kill every woman and child who was a Muslim on the Temple Mount. The contemporaneous descriptions of the event describe soldiers walking on the Temple Mount, a holy place to Christians, with blood running up to their knees. I can tell you that this story is still being told today in the Middle East, and we're still paying for it. You know, sometimes these people, or like President Obama just a couple weeks ago talking about, you know, the Crusaders and, you know, saying we're not blameless, look at the Crusades and everything, as if this is on the same level as ISIS. I wonder if in some ways they're adding fuel to the fire for our enemies at this point.
Yeah, I mean, in a certain sense, I think you could definitely say that. I mean, it's bad history. I mean, frankly, it's not to say that when the First Crusade Army got to the gates of Jerusalem in the summer of 1099, you know, they did go in, they didn't get into the city, obviously. There was, killing and destruction within the city. But again, the point of it that we have to understand is a couple of things. One, that, you know, we're talking about medieval warfare. I mean, warfare is unfortunately violent. And unfortunately, even in our own day and age, you know, in wars today, innocent people and civilians are killed. The difference is that, you know, hopefully, you try to prevent civilian casualties. When you look at people like ISIS and Boko Haram and others, it's the opposite. They actually go out of their way to ensure that civilians and innocents and others are actually killed. Now, that's the point, is to terrorize from that perspective. So it's not in the context of an actual, you know, war or campaign or in the context of the military tactics of the time. You know, in the medieval period, when an army came before the city gates, they gave the city an opportunity to surrender. If the city didn't surrender and decided to defend itself, once the army got into the city, it was kind of no holds barred. I mean, anything kind of went.
And that was true for all kinds of warfare at that time.
Exactly, and that's true with both on Christian side as well as the Islamic side. And the issue with Jerusalem and the so-called massacre is again, you know, what you just read there, the quote from President Clinton, is that we do have contemporary accounts, Christian accounts, that talk about this whole blood, you know, so many people were killed, the blood was running up to the ankle and to the knee, even to the bridle of the horse. And so when we modern people read that, we're horrified by it, but we fail to understand why they chose to use that imagery. And we think of, you know, we read an account of a war or a battle, we're used to understanding, you know, having reporters embedded inside the military units and giving us a factual blow-by-blow account. That was not the case in the medieval period. Instead, you had people writing after the event itself, and they're using language. And in this particular case, great research has been done on these manuscripts, and to see that what was being, why they described it that way was actually a scriptural reference. They're referencing Revelation 14:20, when you have, you know, the judgment, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and the judgment upon the earth, and so much blood was being shed that by that, you know, in judgment, that it was up to the bridle of the horses, for example. And those medieval people who would hear and read these accounts and hear that description, to them, steeped in the scripture, steeped in their faith, they would understand the imagery and know that what's being recorded is that God's judgment on those Islam who held Jerusalem. And so the Crusaders are the ones who liberate the holy city, and they're the arm of God's judgment. That's how they would have understood it. They would not have believed literally
that it was
that,
literal.
You know, blood was running up to the bridle of the horses, right?
Huh. All right, we're talking right now with Steve Weidenkopf, who teaches church history at the Notre Dame Graduate School of Christendom College, which is located where, Steve?
It's in the graduate school is actually in Alexandria, Virginia, and we have an undergrad campus in Front Royal, Virginia.
Oh, okay. And he has written a book called The Glory of the Crusades. For more information on the book, see crusadesbook.com. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. We don't have enough time to individually go through the remaining of those 4 points, but let me go ahead and read all of them and just have you highlight each of them quickly.
Sure.
Okay, supposedly the Crusades were colonial enterprises. Supposedly the wars against the Jews and even the first Holocaust could be viewed as, being parallel to the Crusades. The Crusades were wars of conversion, and also the Crusades are the source of the modern tension between Islam and the West. I mean, in the book, by the way, you put all these things to rest, all these myths. But go ahead and just briefly, one after another. Bing, bing, bing.
Sure. So briefly, in terms of the Crusades being colonial enterprises, your research shows that the vast majority of those who went on crusade and who survived actually left and went back home, went back to Europe, because, again, they saw these things as pilgrimages. And just like today, we'd go on pilgrimage to various different places. You go, you pray at the church, and then you visit the holy sites, and you go back home. That's exactly what they did.
And so then part of this, you were saying earlier that Christian pilgrims were being harassed and sometimes killed by the Seljuk Turks. For example, if they were going to go to Jerusalem. So if somebody was going to go and visit the holy city, they wanted to see the Via Dolorosa, they wanted to see the tomb of Christ, the Holy Sepulchre, and so forth, that in some cases they would be killed. So now what the Crusades were doing were making it free and available for people to go there, Christians, without being harassed and killed.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And so
it's not a colonial thing. It's just a...
No, they weren't colonial things at all. There was no understanding that they were going to go over there and you know, just grab up all this land. They wanted to liberate the land and keep it safe, but, you know, they didn't just create these colonies and exploit the local people or what have you. And again, these kind of feudal territories that erupted after the First Crusade are called what we call them the Crusader States. They were always undermanned. There was never enough troops to guard all of the territory that had initially been liberated during the course of the First Crusade. And it was a constant need for those Christians living in what was called Ultramar, or the Latin East, for Western Christians to come and help them all the time. So there was always a need for steady flow of pilgrims, and of knights, rather, coming from Western Christendom to help those maintain that territory. So it was all about defense and maintaining territory, not expanding or developing these colonial enterprises.
How about the Crusades and the Jews?
Sure, that's one that frequently comes up. Now, there were pogroms, there were persecutions of Jews that did erupt after Urban had called the First Crusade, and even right before and during the time of the Second Crusade, the preaching of the Second Crusade. And these were mostly events down the Rhineland of Germany, and it was by people
Germany.
Who had some people who had taken the cross, and so were vowed crusaders, but instead of going to the Holy Land, they decided to attack Jews in the Rhineland area. And they did so kind of by this false understanding that, you know, why should we travel 2,000 miles away to attack the enemies of Christ in the Holy Land when we can attack the so-called enemies of Christ here in the Rhineland? And also, you know, there was this notion that the many Jews in that area were merchants and had money, and so therefore we could just take their money and use that to be able to finance our expedition. Now, the point of all that is that the church never, ever, ever endorsed that. It was never a stated aim of the Crusades. Urban never, endeavored for these crusaders to attack Jews. And in fact, in most of these cities where this did occur, the bishop of the city protected the Jews, welcomed them into his palace to try to protect them, tried to get these kind of warriors that were going off on their own to stop harassing the Jews.
Yeah.
And so it was never a stated aim of any of the Crusades, but you still kind of hear that that was part of the Crusades, and that's not true at all.
I have a quote here from your book. St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who did preach the Second Crusade, heard about some of this, what you're talking about, and he said, quote, "We have heard with joy that zeal for God burns in you, but wisdom must not be lacking from this zeal. The Jews are not to be persecuted, nor killed, nor even forced to flee," end quote, from Bernard of Clairvaux, who also went on to rebuke one of those who would preach that kind of thing. Okay, what about the idea? We know that the Crusades weren't wars of conversion in the sense of it wasn't like jihad where, you know, convert or die. But what about the idea that the Crusades are the source of modern tension between Islam and the West? Even when the leader of the Coptics that were killed the other day, the leader of the, Islamic group that killed the 21 Christians, beheaded them, he used the word crusaders. So they're still fighting the Crusades, even though those things ended hundreds of years ago. What is your comment to that, that the Muslims still remember the Crusades?
Yeah, on the surface, it seems as if, you know, that they believe they're still fighting the Crusades. And in a certain sense, you know, if ISIS and others, I mean, think they are. But when you look at the history of the Crusades in the Islamic world, for the most part, the Crusades were kind of a non-event in the Islamic world, frankly. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, you know, the actual campaigns in the Holy Land only last for about 200 years. It's not a very significant period of Islamic history. Frankly, in the end, you know, Islam won, and there was no permanent presence anymore of Christians from the West in the Holy Land anymore. So, for the most part, they were forgotten in the Islamic world until you get to the 19th century, actually. The very first Crusade history written in Arabic didn't appear until 1899. And the reason for that was it was an advisor to the Ottoman Turkish Sultan, who the Ottoman Turks had been, as we mentioned earlier, their empire had been declining and degrading since their defeat at the Gates of Vienna in the end of the 17th century. It was even further in decline by the end of the 19th century, and this advisor to the Ottoman Sultan blamed the Crusades for why things were bad and why they were going wrong. He used it as a form of propaganda to deflect criticism from the Sultan and his policies and place it at the hands of Christians, you know, several hundred years ago in the Crusades. And so from there, it begins to be kind of pick up this story in the Islamic world that, you know, all of the reasons why we're suffering political and economic and military downturns are all because of these, you know, early, quote, you know, European colonial efforts during the Crusades. And that picks up steam in the 1970s when you have Arab nationalism and this kind of anti-Western movement in these Islamic countries. It picks up further steam during the Islamic Revolution in Iran in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And then by the time you get to the 20th century, 21st century, you have these very, these terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and ISIS who are now using this terminology as a form of propaganda to recruit soldiers and others into their way of thinking in order to terrorize, the indigenous Christians as well as try to attack the West. So they paint this picture that we're still fighting the Crusades, but again, that's a much more modern interpretation and not something that, you know, Muslims from, let's say, you know, the 13th century all the way up to the 19th century had any real comprehension and understanding of.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, even just 70 years ago or 65 years ago when Eisenhower sat down to write his memoirs of his victory in Europe, what did he call it? Crusade in Europe. There was no problem with that. There were football teams or were high school teams, you know, basketball, whatever, Crusaders. And, now it's become almost like, you know, a Holocaust participator or something. I mean, Crusaders like among the worst. It's amazing. And yet this change has happened just in our lifetime, it seems.
Yes, very true. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How about a closing thought, 20 to 30 seconds on the Crusades in general? Again, crusadesbook.com for more information. The Glory of the Crusades. Our guest has been Professor Steve Weidenkopf, which is spelled Weidenkopf. Again, for more information, crusadesbook.com. Closing thoughts, sir, on the Crusades.
Sure, closing. I think the Crusades, you know, as we know, receive kind of a bad rap, so to speak, in our modern world.
At least,
of all these myths. And so, what I hope to do with my book is to, again, present this information that historians have known actually for the last 40, 50 years. that these myths are all incorrect, and there's many good research that's been done to illustrate and to defend the church against these myths. And so the hope is that people will be empowered and encouraged by this book and this material in order to defend the church when she's attacked. And what I would encourage people is to not just give in to the accepted narrative that's being told, that's, you know, people like President Obama gave at the National Prayer Breakfast, but rather question where that narrative comes from, and then search and seek out and find the authentic history and be able to defend our faith and defend the church against those who attack it in the modern world.
Thank you, Steve, for being with us. All the best.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it so much.
Okay, thank you now. Bye-bye.